Before us today is the parable of the unjust steward. The parable of the unjust steward. It's found in Luke chapter 16, verses, we're going to call it 1 through 17. Verses 1 through 8 is the parable itself. And then Jesus is going to have some follow-up conversation after the parable, verses 9 through 17. So we're going to call this verses 1 through 17. The parable of the unjust steward. It is one of the trickiest parables to understand. It's one of those parables that's just got hard concepts in it and difficult wording. And every time you have a parable like that, by the way, usually it's written by Luke, but when you have a parable like that, go figure, he's a doctor. You know, they do the same thing with their signatures as they do with their writing things up. But when you have a parable like that, usually, unfortunately, what comes from that are misconceptions. And man, I can't think of a parable in the scriptures that has more misconceptions to it than the parable that we're going to look at today. Since our motto here at Anchored Fellowship is what? Oh, no one knows. Level-headed Christianity. It's on our signs, folks. It's like on everything. Anchored Fellowship, level-headed Christianity. Since that's our motto, that's going to help us with this parable. We're going to take a level-headed look at this section of scriptures, this parable, to help you make proper sense of it. And the key to properly interpreting this parable is this: stick with what Jesus says. When you read the parable and you get down to verse 8 and you're done with the parable, don't feel like you have to make all of your assumptions and interpretations at that point. Watch the rest of what Jesus has to say on down to verse 17. If you'll do that, you won't be misguided about what Jesus is saying. You'll get the point. You'll understand the meaning of it all, okay? The major topic in this parable is money. Now wait, don't leave yet, please. We're going to be talking about money. But unless we get down to verse 10, you don't have to be worrying about sweating it out just yet. When we get to verse 10, that's where stuff's really going to apply to us, and you might clutch your wallet or purse a little tight and wiggle in your seat a little bit and maybe start to beat up with sweat. But unless we get that far today, you have nothing to worry about. The parable is about money, and that is a subject that Jesus covers a lot in the scriptures. For obvious reason, people really care about money. Sometimes way, way, way too much. Money talks. And because money talks, our Lord talks about money a lot. In a study from years ago, research bared out this statistic that men and women in their free thinking time, so that's, you know, like just kind of when you have downtime, not when you're thinking about what do I need to make for food or what do I need to do on my job, just your free thinking time, it is estimated that about 50% of our free thinking time evolves around the topic of money, either how to spend what we've got or how to get more. And if you look at the parables of Jesus, 12 of the 38 parables that Jesus taught us all had some inclusion of the topic or thought of money. So it's an important topic because everyone needs it. We all use it to live. Some of us want it. Some of us lust after it. It's a very important topic, and let's take a look at what the Lord has to say about it in this parable. Verse 1, he also said to his disciples, now let me just stop us right there from the get-go. You're thinking, yeah, that's Arlen, we didn't get very far at all, and he already needs to talk. But I do just want to point out that in Luke chapter 14, we began a study on the dinner conversations of Jesus with a bunch of people. And we weren't really sure if that one verse was telling us that Jesus up and left and great multitudes followed him, or if that verse was trying to communicate to us that great multitudes followed Jesus to that dinner party. So there is a very definite chance, and I admit I lean toward believing this, that Luke was actually telling us that great multitudes went with Jesus to this party and congregated outside of the party. We talked about that. You remember that. I won't go into that anymore. But that means that when we get to Luke chapter 16, we're still at the dinner table. We're still in dinner conversation, and the last people that Jesus was talking to in the parable of the prodigal son or the parable of the loving father was the scribes and the Pharisees. Pardon me, the Pharisees and the lawyers. Well, the scribes are usually guilty, but that's kind of the same thing, the scribes and lawyers, right? So he was talking to them. Now, for a moment, he has diverted his attention away from the scribes and Pharisees. They finally shut their trap, so Jesus left them alone for a bit. And now he's talking specifically to his disciples. That's important because when we get down further into this chapter, we're going to find out that even though Jesus is not talking to the Pharisees, yet the Pharisees are still eavesdropping and they're highly offended at what you're about to read. They don't like the implications that our Lord gives from this parable. So he said to his disciples, there was a certain rich man who had a steward, and an accusation was brought to him, to the boss, that this man, the manager, was wasting his goods. So this guy that's supposed to run his business was mismanaging the business. Verse 2, so he called him and said to him, what is this I hear about you? Give an account of your stewardship, for you can no longer be steward. Now, in this parable so far, we have a master and a steward. That is the same thing as a boss and a manager. That's the same thing as the owner and the executive or the administrator that's running the business for the owner. It would be the steward's responsibility, the manager's responsibility to manage every aspect of his master's business. He operated with full authority. He knew his master's rules for the business. He knew his master's price structure, operates within full authority to go out and to cut deals and to sell product or service, whatever this owner was selling, and set the prices and keep track of the bills to know who owes what to his master, his boss. And a good example of this would be Pharaoh and Joseph, what we're covering in our Wednesday night studies. Pharaoh would be the boss, the master. Joseph would be the steward, and Joseph operates within full authority of the master, knowing the master's wishes and just taking the business and running with it and doing everything that he needs to operate the business in order to prosper the owner of the business, the master. Now, Joseph is about the best manager you could ever dream to find if you were running a business. Unfortunately, though, he's about one of a kind. And this manager in Luke 16 is certainly no Joseph. If this accusation from verse 1 is accurate, that means this manager is a crook. And we just read that he was wasting his master's goods. That word wasting is the same word that is used for the prodigal son. That's what that word wasting means. Wasting or wasteful means prodigal. So technically, we have back-to-back parables, the parable of the prodigal son and the parable of the prodigal steward, the wasteful steward. And that word, wasteful, is a word that is in the present active tense. The present active tense. And I said that just to simply communicate to you that when it says he was wasting his master's goods, that does not mean this was a one-time thing. Like one time he ripped his boss off, you know, stole some pencils from the desk, took some erasers home, or accidentally left some post-it notes in his bag and took them home. This was more than a one-time thing. This was an active, ongoing, repeated thing. He was cooking the books, is what he was doing. You ever hear that expression? he was cooking the books for this business to benefit from it. It's what we would call a white-collar crime. Now, thankfully, we have law enforcement to investigate white-collar crime and take upon punitive measures to deal with white-collar crime. Aren't you thankful for that? Only an insane society would decide to do away with their law enforcement. Am I right? So this steward, he has been pre-fired. Well, okay, he's technically been fired, but he is supposed to return to the business and turn over the books that he's been cooking. So it's his exit interview where he's going to bring all of the records to show what kind of business he's done for the master, and his books are going to be audited. That's his exit interview. Verse 3. Then the steward said within himself, in other words, he's thinking to himself, "What shall I do? For my master is taking the stewardship away from me. I cannot dig. There's no way I'm going to go out and work in the fields and plant stuff and pluck stuff up. I'm just no farmer. I'm not all that interested in manual labor." Boy, he's sounding exactly like management, isn't he? I don't want to get my hands dirty. Don't make me do manual labor. And he says this, "I am ashamed to beg," which is interesting because he wasn't ashamed to be a crook all those years, but he is ashamed to go out there at the intersection and hold the sign up that says, "We'll cook your books for food." No, he's not going to beg. He's not going to do. He's too proud. Man, he's been an executive in the estate. He's had a cushy position. Maybe that's why he can't dig. You know, he's put on a little weight from sitting at the desk and recording numbers. Verse 4, "I have resolved what to do." I got it, he says. I got a game plan. I know how I'm going to deal with the loss of my job. "That when I am put out of the stewardship, they, you're going to find out who the they is in verse 5, "that they may receive me into their houses," verse 5, "so he called every one of his master's debtors to him." Just keep in mind that line for a second, because we're going to be given an example of two debtors that this guy has a business deal with. But he did this, what he does with these next two debtors, he did this with every single person that owed his master money. This was like across the board financial havoc that was going to be wreaked upon this master of the business. He says that he called every one of his master's debtors to him and said to the first, this is the first debtor, he said, "How much do you owe my master?" Verse 6, and he said, 100 measures of oil." So the first debtor has bartered for goods or services from the master. He's not paying cash value, but he has bartered something on the basis of credit. That is, he has received a good or a service from this owner, and the deal is that remaining on his bill is a due payment to the master of 100 measures of oil. That is a lot of oil. That is about 1,000 gallons of oil. Now, you know, we're not talking about crude oil, right? The steward may be crude. The oil is not. We're talking about olive oil. Do you know how much pressing in the olive press you have to do to get 1,000 gallons of olive oil? This guy has a lot of work to do to square up his bill with the master. This is a very pressing issue for this man. He's got a lot of pressing to do. What do you give that one, Rachel? About a 6, 7? That is worse than I thought. But the reviewers never lie. So this is 3 years worth of wage that this guy owes this business owner. It makes you wonder, just what did this debtor purchase from this owner? It makes you wonder, was Snap-on tools a thing back then too? Maybe this guy owned the first Hobby Lobby. I don't know, but man, he is in major debt to this owner. And reading on in verse 4, he said to him, take your bill. Now, I like this. I really like this. This is sly. He's not going to take the bill and put it in his own handwriting because the bill's going to get changed. He wants nothing to, he's trying not to incriminate himself. He's trying to keep himself out of the record. So it's not even going to be his handwriting. He says, okay, here, you take your bill. And he says, sit down quickly. Well, definitely quickly. When you're doing something underhanded, you better get moving at it and get it done before you get caught. Sit down quickly and write 50. You owe 100, but write 50. We're slashing prices today. Today only, 50% off, zero APR, everything must go. You pay today, you're getting it for half off. You're getting a major deal. Verse 7, then he said to another, and how much do you owe? So he said, 100 measures of wheat. And he said to him, take your bill and write 80. You owe 100, write 80. That's what you now owe. And it's the same type of thing here. The second buyer has bartered for 100 measures of wheat. Now, he does not get the 50% discount. I don't know, maybe he didn't like this guy as much. He only gets a 20% discount, but it's still really good. I know how you are. I know how I am. When you see something in the store that's 50% off, you're buying it. You probably don't even need it, but it's 50% off. So you buy it. Some of you do that even when it's only like a 20% discount. Like, I don't need this. I'm never going to use it, but it's 20% off. I got to get it. This is a steal. So you spend money. You lose money. You would have had to buy the thing you didn't really need just because they enticed you with the discount. Hey, this is still a good discount. It's still a good deal nonetheless, because 100 measures of wheat is equivalent to 1,000 bushels of wheat, and you need about 100 acres to work, to harvest, in order to end up with 1,000 bushels of wheat. This is a lot of work, so he's just cut his work down to 20%. And we're starting to see now that this steward, this prodigal steward, this unjust steward, has a very cunning game plan. And we see what it is now. He's losing his income. He's been pre-fired. He's been fired. He's losing his income. He's losing his home, which would be on the estate that he was managing for. He's losing his income. He's losing his home. All because he's losing his job. But before he turns the books over, he quickly cuts all of these debtors a deal, and he's in a big hurry to do it. You saw the word quickly there. He's in a big hurry to do it. Quickly, quickly. I got to turn in the records. I got to head out there for my exit interview, so hurry and quickly. Let's doctor the books. It's a gone out of business deal. No, my boss isn't gone out of business, but I'm getting thrown out of the business. So these are my going out of business deals, and we got to be quick. Just like Mundell's, they've had that going out of business sale for, what's it been now, 10 years? Boy, when they plan a thing, they plan it well. Let's plan right now to go out of business. 10 years from now, that'll be our last day. Get the signs up. They're fooling us. That feels crooked to me. But anyway, so by cutting these deals, this very intelligent and cunning steward has accomplished two things. Two things. Number one, he has made these debtors grateful to him. And number two, he has made these debtors that were indebted to his boss, he has now made them indebted to him. So when, not if, he knows the hard times are coming, but when the hard time comes, what he'll do is he'll go back to all of these people that he cut these incredible deals for, and he's going to appeal first to their gratitude. You know, I already scratched your back. You scratch mine now. You remember me? I cut you that incredible deal. I saved you all of that wheat, all of that oil. Well, hey, I need a place to crash for a couple weeks. Can I stay with you? So that's what he's doing. That's his plan. Appeal to gratitude first. If that doesn't work, he has all of these people indebted to him because he has leverage on them. Remember, it wasn't him that changed the bill. It was them that changed their own bills. And he would turn to them in that moment. If they refuse out of gratitude to extend the same kindness back to him, he can say, hold on a minute now before you shut your front door and don't let me in. Hold on just a minute. You're in this thing with me. I'm not the only one that committed the white collar crime here. You're in this completely and totally with me. You're guilty of the same crime that I'm guilty of. So, because I have you as an accomplice in this crime, if you refuse me, return gratitude, I'll start naming names to the boss. I'll start spreading the word. What a plan, huh? This guy's smart, really smart. Verse 8, So the master beat the tar out of the unjust steward. Is that what your version says? I got the wrong version today, sorry. That's what I expect my version to say, but it doesn't say that. You would expect the master to be fuming that he had been ripped off like this, but verse 8 says, the master commended the unjust steward because he had dealt shrewdly. Now, perhaps cleverly would be a better word there for this passage. This master complimented him on how clever he was. He ingeniously worked ahead to plan for his future, and you can't hardly fault a person for that, can you? I mean, at least that aspect of the motivation is honorable, right? He was thinking of his future. He was trying to, in advance, provide for himself. Now, anchored, please hear some of these statements. They're very important. This is not God condoning the crime of theft. This is not God encouraging us to rip one another off and outsmart one another out of our dollar bills. This is a business owner, and all he's saying is, this guy ripped me off, and he's going to pay for that. I fired him. He's even more fired now. I'm even more mad about what he did to me after I fired him. It doesn't change any of that, but what this business owner is saying is that, hey, you got to give the guy credit for this. He hatched a grand scheme and outsmarted me. I mean, it was intelligent. It's like, you know, you see someone doing something and they're doing it all wrong and they look so stupid and you're just kind of laughing at them because you're like, oh, I can't believe they're trying to do that like that. And what do you usually say in those occasions? You usually say, well, at least they're trying their hardest. You know, give them A for effort. That's what he's saying to this guy. A for effort. Brilliant plan. It even tricked me. So that's all that's being said here. If I ever hear one anchored person say that this in Luke 16, verse 8, is God commending injustice or wrongdoing or unscrupulous behavior, if I ever hear one anchored person say that, I think my head's going to explode, and if it doesn't, I'm retiring. That's not what's happening here, okay? The master in this story, this is what you got to know. The master in this story is not our master. See, we're always looking for the parables of direct compare because those are the most common that we get. We get the master and the servant, and the master is the Lord and the servant is us. And we run with those themes. We're looking for those themes. We're waiting for the parables of compare. This one is not a parable of compare. It is a parable of contrast. And this master in this story is not to be compared to our master. So this steward, taking the story for what it's worth, is just flat out a bad example of human behavior. But as bad of an example as he has set, like in almost every case, There is something good that you can learn from a bad example. And that is all that is taking place here. And that's exactly what Jesus is now going to do. He's going to take a look at this crooked man, this unscrupulous man. He's going to look at what he's done, and he's going to find something praiseworthy or commendable about what he did. It doesn't change the fact that there's a whole bunch of stuff about this story that the Lord does not condone or does not approve, but we know our God is this by nature. He looks for the good to approve the good in us. And the Apostle Paul taught us the very same thing in New Testament principle. He told us to approve the things that are excellent. And he says that in matters of discernment. In other words, this is in matters that pertain to you and another person or you and other people in the fellowship. And God says through Paul, inspiring Paul to write, that in your matters with the fellowship, here's what you should be doing. Not looking for the bad to bash the bad. That's easy enough to see and detect. But looking for the good in people so that you can be approving and commending of the good that you see in them. That's the character of our Father in heaven. It should be our character. And Jesus is getting ready to launch into that. He's going to find one aspect from this story that, believe it or not, is worth emulating for you and I. Amazing, isn't it? You can find good in almost any situation. Reading on in verse 8. Brace yourself for this one. I'm glad we don't have you guys stand for the teaching. You need to be seated for this. He says, "For the sons of this world are more shrewd, more clever in their generation than the sons of light." Can I put that to you in our modern terminology? He's saying that unbelievers are more clever in their generation than believers are. Ouch. Did that sting? To hear Jesus say that? Now, I'm going to try to cushion the blow a little bit of that statement, because as we're trying to extract the full and correct message of this statement, there's one thing more important than anything else, and that is context. Context is everything here. This is not a blanket statement. Christians are dumb, and sinners are clever. You wouldn't expect that from Jesus. Of course not. He wouldn't say that. That's not what's being said. Context is everything. So in the context, in the full context, the correct message would be what? What did the steward's cleverness involve? What was he being clever about? I already told you. He was being clever about his future. Let me give you a better word. He was being clever about his self-preservation. His self-preservation. And he was willing to do anything for the sake of self-preservation. Now, I can't believe I'm going to say this, but Satan was right in the book of Job, chapter 2, verse 4, when Satan answered the Lord and said, "Skin for skin, yes, anything that a man has, he will give for his life." That's a true statement by and large, not all the time, but generally, Satan is right about that statement, and that's why he attacked Job the way that he did. The general idea is this, that when it comes down to a person losing their life, they'll do whatever it takes to self-preserve. If that means ripping someone off, you rip them off. If that means cheating a little bit on the time clock, whatever it might mean, if you're trying to preserve your life, you will do anything that it takes to do just that, preserve your life. It was certainly the case for this unjust steward. And what this verse is saying is that sinners of this world will go to any extreme to make sure that their physical, listen to the words I'm emphasizing, they'll go to any extreme to make sure that their physical futures are preserved, but in contrast, here's the message of Jesus in verse 8. believers usually do not match the intensity and the passion of unbelievers in pursuing their spiritual goals. Now, I know that didn't soften it much, did it? It helps us a little bit. At least now we know the Lord's not calling us dumb saved people. But man, that's a tough statement to hear. It still stings because the Lord has just told us that the worldling is more determinedly clever at physical self-preservation than the Christian is at spiritual, eternal self-preservation. And that is a crying shame. The worldling that's got a monetary goal in his mind, a boat to buy or a car to buy or a house to build onto. The worldling that has a monetary goal in mind, he'll get up in the morning before the birds and hit the office or the shop. And he'll still be there working late, late, late after the birds have gone to sleep. Absolutely passionate fervor drives them toward their worldly, temporal, ungodly, unnecessary goals. And then you have the Christian. I'm so glad I'm saved. Maybe I'll spend the day seeking the face of God. Oh, that's right, my show's on. That's the kind of thing. Hey, don't get mad at me. The Lord said this. That's the kind of thing that he's saying. The world will do anything that it takes to get those few extra dollars. But how about the Christian? Is the Christian as determined about spiritual, eternal things as the worldling is about money? Does the Christian scour the pages of the Word of God looking for every advantage in spiritual life? Do we read the Word? Do we spend time in prayer? Do we spend time worshiping and seeking the face of God? Just all as a matter of working toward our spiritual, eternal self-preservation in the kingdom. Are we that fervent? Are we that passionate? Are we that motivated? Right now, I think it's still the same as it was in Jesus' day. Jesus is talking about his generation. I don't think it's changed in our generation. I think it's still the same. I think the world has us beat in their intensity to pursue their worldly goals. I think they pursue those with more fire than the Christian pursues his or her Christianity. And man, it shouldn't be that way. I pray that the day comes where anchored fellowship takes the lead, if that were a competition, takes the lead in that competition. That the world can't match our passion for Christ. That the world can't match our intensity, our determination, and our work ethic in the kingdom. Now, please do keep in mind, your salvation is a free gift. And the Lord here is talking about people in the kingdom, whether they're working or not, whether they're all that motivated or not, they're in the kingdom. They're sons and daughters of light. Your salvation is free. That's a gift. You don't have to get all passionate and emotional and fervent just so that the Lord, you know, locks your spot in. And it doesn't change with the day. Arlen is not doing too well today. Let's mark him at about 60% chance of heaven. It's like the rain. You know, what's my chance today, Lord? Huh? It's low today. Got to be honest, low today. You had a bad week, 20%. So that's not what's being said, of course. But man, can the church take this message and run with it. God, help us. Help us in our motivation. Help us in our spiritual work ethic. Help us in our passion within the kingdom. Verse 9, and I say to you, make friends for yourselves in this area of unrighteous mammon, that when you fail, now the Greek word here is eklipo, which means to cease or die. Some translations will translate this to say that when your money fails, I don't think that's what's being said here, in the original language, eklipo in the Greek, meaning cease or die, it's saying that when you die, when you cease, they may receive you into an everlasting home. That word mammon is an important word. Some versions translate that word mammon as money. But mammon is such a necessary word because mammon is so much more than just money. Mammon is the demonic entity behind the love of money and the worship of money. You know, in the Old Testament, when they worshiped idols and they had their false gods, man, they just weren't like making stuff up. They knew there was power behind those things they were praying to. And there was power, spiritual power. It just wasn't God's power. It wasn't pure power. There are demonic entities behind every false god. And that goes for Allah too. And I'm not afraid to say it. There are false demonic spirits behind idols and false gods. So when you're looking at the word money, you need to be thinking of more than just money. First of all, you see the word unrighteous attached to it. That should tip you off. What we're talking about here is not just money, but the love of money, the worship of money. It's when you make money your God. It's okay if you own the money. What's not okay is if the money owns you. Money is an excellent servant, a terrific servant, but a terrible master. You know how you know if you love money? Go to your bank account, put all your money in your bank account if it's not in there. No, better yet, take all your money out in the largest denominations you can. Hold it in your hand and see how valuable it is to you. See what your heart does. Could I give this away? If you got, you know, $2,000 or $4,000 in there, you're getting some big bills. Hold up one of those $1,000 bills. Has anyone ever seen any one of those? Have you ever held one of those in your hand? It's a huge bill. Hold that in your hand and say, what would I think or what would I feel if I just took this bill right now and put it in the paper shredder? Just don't do it. Give it to me before you do that. But just test it, right? That's going to tell you a lot. Here's another way to test your position with money on who's in charge of your money. Is it you or is the money in charge of you? Here's another way to do it. Just keep with us in this study today, and we're not going to get through all of it. So stay with us in our next study next week about money. And if you find yourself reacting viscerally like the Pharisees are about to over this teaching on money, if you find that to be your reaction, that instead of delighting in what the Lord has to say about finances, if you too jump on board with the Pharisees and deride him instead of delighting in him, that's showing you where you stand in relation to money, and you need to be careful. So mammon is when money becomes your religion, your God. And after challenging the believer's dedication to eternal things, he now helps us by drawing from this parable one clever trick that we should pull out of our sleeves as believers in order to gain a kingdom advantage. It's this: if we know that nearly the whole world, the whole unbelieving world, is all caught up in the love of money and the worship of money, and money is their religion. If we know that, if we know the value of money to the worldling, then why aren't we as the church using our financial generosity to make friends with them? Look at that verse. Keep that verse. Keep looking at that verse while I say this, because I want it to click. If we know in this area of unrighteous mammon what the world thinks about money, why aren't we leveraging that just as this unjust steward did? Why aren't we leveraging that to make friends with the unbelieving world whose God is money? Because when we make friends with the world, we get their ear. And when we get their ear, we can give them the gospel. And when we give them the gospel, there is the chance that one day when we approach the gates of heaven, guess who's waiting there to receive us in, just as this passage says? The people that you reached through using cleverly, shrewdly, unrighteous mammon. Can you imagine that? Getting to heaven and you having a welcome party. That's what this verse is saying. You having a welcome party, a warm reception into heaven, and there's a bunch of people waiting to greet you at the gate. I'm not getting my hopes up. There's a few, I'm happy. But what if you get there and there's all these people waiting to receive you into eternity with the Lord, and they say things like this to you: Arlen, I'm here because of you. Rachel, I'm here because of you. Dawn, I'm here because of you. Judy, I'm here because of you. What do you mean you're here because of me? Because you invested your money in the kingdom, and the kingdom reached me. You invested your money in missions, and I got saved through those missions. You invested your money in a Christian publishing company, and I read their book, or I read their tract, and I got saved. Or you invested in K-Love Radio, and one day I accidentally got that thing on the wrong dial, and K-Love came on, and I heard a song, and it changed my life, and it led me to salvation. Or how about this one? This is my favorite. I'm here in heaven partially because of you, because you financially supported your local church, and your local church reached me with the gospel. So when it comes to this idea of using unrighteous mammon, understand that this can be done directly or indirectly. Now, Jesus is not saying to, you know, in a seedy, underhanded way, offer money to be your friend. You know, like, hey, bub, here's 20 bucks. Can we be friends? No? How about 50? I'm not saying that. But it's investing our money in a way that gives us kingdom advantage. It is an investment in that eternal kingdom, and it can be direct. It can be you out there saying to the unbeliever that you know their God is money. So you say to them, hey, I'm going to cut you a deal. You cut people a deal, you're going to have friends for life. Or how about this? People owe you money and you know money is their God. So you say, forget it. I'm wiping the debt clean. You don't owe me anything. You got friends for life. How about this one? Try this one. Go give someone your car. Just give them your car. Here's a car. It's free. It's yours. Friend for life. So you can do direct, or you can do indirect, which is where you invest in others that are doing the work and reaching the people. And the great thing is you still get credit. That work is yours. You're part of that. You're engaged in that. You're invested in that. And we're going to talk about that in great detail next week. Our financial generosity. Our financial generosity. And it's a big one. Our financial faithfulness. Bring your hard hats next week. And then the week after that's going to be even tougher, because the week after that, 2 weeks from now, we're going to take only Luke chapter 16, verse 18. Yes, we're going to spend the whole service on one verse. If you read that verse, you know why we're going to be on it a whole day. It's going to be our intensive and exhaustive study through marriage, divorce, and remarriage. What's right? What's wrong? What does the Bible say? What does the Lord think? 2 weeks from now,